The lyrics went, Monday, Monday, can't trust that day. Monday, Monday, sometimes it turns out that way. Oh, Monday morning, you gave me no warning of what it would be, that Monday evening you would leave and not take me. Every other day of the week is fine, but when every Monday comes, you find me crying all of the time. Monday, Monday, couldn't guarantee that Monday evening you would still be here with me. The songwriter had experienced a warm, pleasant weekend with his girlfriend, but on Monday he got dumped. This is what happened to Jesus. On Sunday, Jesus rode his donkey into the city of Jerusalem to the cheers of the crowd. He was the Messiah to the masses. It was a heady day that Sunday. But on Monday morning, Jesus confronted an entirely different attitude in the temple. The Jewish leaders didn't appreciate that he had upset the temple trade the day before. Jesus had become a threat to the establishment's power and profits. The Jewish religious hierarchy grew so mad that they wanted to accuse Jesus, even kill him if they could. It had been a wonderful weekend, a glorious Sunday, but now it was Monday. And it happened on one of those days, as he taught the people in the temple and preached the gospel, that the chief priests and the scribes, together with the elders, confronted him. I like showdowns. One of my favorite movies is The Shootist, where John Wayne, a famous gunslinger dying of cancer, sets up a showdown with three villains. He sends him an invitation to meet him at the Metropole, the town saloon, on his birthday, in fact. And Wayne guns him down at high noon. He ends his life and goes out in a blaze of glory. It was high noon in the temple on this Monday when three villains, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders, strolled into the temple looking for Jesus. The day before, Jesus had sent him an invitation to meet him at high noon. Jesus knew when he had driven out the money changers and the merchants that the Jewish leaders wouldn't take it lying down. A confrontation would come, and here it is. And they spoke to him saying, Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things? Or who is he who gave you this authority? Jesus had challenged their authority. What right do you have to make my Father's house into a den of thieves? Now they're picking up the gauntlet. Who are you to tell us what we should and shouldn't do? Where do you get your authority? Like all the questions that were asked Jesus that day, this question was a trap. Authority was a touchy subject under Roman rule. If Jesus claimed to act under divine authority, he could become a potential enemy of Rome, or at least be painted as such. If Jesus said he lacked authority, he would lose credibility amongst the people. And so it was a catch-22. But he answered and said to them, I will also ask you one thing, and answer me. The baptism of John, was it from heaven or from men? Jesus uses the Socratic method. He answers a question with a question. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, If we say from heaven, he will say, Why then did you not believe in him? But if we say from men, all the people will stone us, for they are persuaded that John was a prophet. And so they did a very brave, courageous thing. They answered that they did not know where he was from. They refused to go out on a limb. They played dumb, is what they did. Actually, by the end of this Monday, we discover that it was really not hard for these Jews to play dumb at all. Because they were pretty dumb. Whenever you try to match wits with the master, you end up the dimwit. That's what happened that day. Throughout that Monday, the most brilliant minds in Judaism tried to argue Scripture with its author. They tried to argue theology with the theos. They take on the original Bible answer man, and they prove how dumb they really are. And Jesus said to them, Then neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. If you aren't willing to go out on a limb to answer me, well, then I won't go out on a limb to answer you. Round one, in my opinion, goes to Jesus. Then he began to tell the people this parable. A certain man planted a vineyard, leased it to vine dressers, and went into a far country for a long time. Now, this was a common business arrangement in Israel. A landowner would invest the capital and transform his land into a vineyard. Then he would lease it out to the vine dressers, expecting a percentage of the profits come harvest time. Now, at vintage time, he sent a servant to the vine dressers that they might give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the vine dressers beat him and sent him away empty-handed. Again, he sent another servant, and they beat him also, treated him shamefully, and sent him away empty-handed. And again, he sent a third, and they wounded him also and cast him out. Now, I'm sure the owner of the vineyard didn't really like whining about the situation. But his tenants had forgotten that they were just tenants. You'd assume they were drinking the profits by the way they were treating the owner's servants. Then the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my beloved son. Probably they will respect him when they see him. But when the vine dressers saw him, they reasoned among themselves, saying, 'This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, that the inheritance may be ours.'" Under Jewish law, any tract of land that was ownerless could be laid claim to by anyone else. And so they felt that by killing the son, they could then take ownership of this man's vineyard. And so they cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. Now, there was no question that Jesus' parable was actually a prophecy. In fact, it would be fulfilled by the end of this week. Israel was the vineyard. In fact, just a few feet west of where Jesus was standing in the temple were the huge double doors that led into the holy place. They were over 100 feet high. And they had grapevines, golden grapevines engraved on these doors. Israel was the vineyard. The vineyard was a symbol for Israel. The Jewish leaders were the tenants. The servants of the owner were the prophets, and the owner's son was Jesus Christ. The Jewish leaders were so power hungry that they tried to silence God's authority by beating his servants. Then they tried to steal the kingdom from God himself by butchering his beloved son. These guys were villains with a capital V. And Jesus asks, therefore, what will the owner of the vineyard do to them? What do you think the owner of this vineyard is going to do to these guys? He will come and destroy those vine dressers and give the vineyard to others. In Matthew 15, verse 26, Jesus had said, "I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Jesus in the early church preached the gospel first to the Jews, but then to the Gentiles. First, though, to the Jews. And when the Jewish establishment rejected the testimony of Peter in the early church, God redirected the good news to the Gentiles. In 70 AD, the institutions of Judaism, the temple and the priesthood, really the bastions of opposition to the early church, these institutions were destroyed by the Romans. God destroyed the vine dressers and gave the vineyard to the others being the church. The gospel was refocused now to the Gentiles. The treasures of God now given to the church. The church now became the new temple of God on the earth. And by the 2nd century A.D., the membership of the church was almost exclusively Gentile. But when they heard it, they said, "Certainly not." The Jewish leaders understood the implications of Jesus' statements, but they pleaded innocent. This could never happen. And he looked at them. Ooh, he looked at them. The Greek word here translated "look" means to look in or see through. Jesus gave them a look that cut right to their hearts. They had acted appalled, incensed that anyone would be audacious enough to murder God's beloved son and try to steal his kingdom. And yet that's exactly what they had planned. That's exactly the plan that they had hatched in their heart. The look that Jesus gave them sliced through their phony innocence. In essence, He was saying, I know what you're plotting. And they knew that He knew. He looked at them and He said, what then is this that is written? The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Jesus quotes here Psalm 118 verse 22. A messianic psalm that was actually built on an ancient story. The construction of the temple was quite an engineering feat. It was an amazing engineering feat. The temple was built with huge stones, some 20 foot thick and 40 feet long. The stones were quarried some distance from Jerusalem and they were assembled on the site. They were so sculpted that they interlocked without even the use of mortar. There were no nails in the walls of the temple. They all fit perfectly together. But there was one stone that didn't seem to fit. And so when the builders received it, they looked it over and they thought it must have been a mistake. And they tossed it over the side, rolled it over the side of the Temple Mount down into the Valley of Kidron. When the construction was complete, though, they found that they were missing the capstone, the cornerstone. And they realized that this was the stone that they had rejected, that they had said really didn't fit. The builders of Judaism are about to make this same mistake. Jesus was the capstone or the fulfillment of Judaism. And yet they didn't see how He fit in with their system. He didn't fit in with their legalism and their ritualism and their prejudice and their self-righteousness. And so He was discarded by the religious leaders. And yet God has used Him to build another temple, the church. And He has become the chief cornerstone now of Christianity, the foundation of our faith and fellowship. Jesus says, and whoever falls on that stone will be broken, but on whomever it falls, it will grind him to powder. Humble yourself. Fall down on Jesus Christ, and He'll give you the power you need to change your life. Harden yourself. And Jesus will fall on you and grind you to powder. The choice for all of us is power or powder. Fall on Jesus willingly with a repentant heart, or Jesus will fall on you with judgment. And the chief priests and the scribes that very hour sought to lay hands on Him, but they feared the people. For they knew that He had spoken this parable against them. So they watched Him, and they sent spies who pretended to be righteous, that they might seize on His words in order to deliver Him to the power and the authority of the governor. They hoped for some reason that they could find some reason to get the Romans involved, to let the Romans do their dirty work. And they asked Him, saying, Teacher, we know that you say and teach rightly, and you do not show personal favoritism, but teach the way of God truly. Phony flattery. They're buttering Him up before they stick the knife into Him. Or they try. They ask, is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? But He perceived their craftiness and said to them, why do you test me? The Roman poll tax was, in essence, an existence tax. Everyone was required to pay. But whether to pay this tax or not was a hotly debated subject in Jewish circles. And either way that Jesus answered this question, it would have gotten Him in trouble with some of the Jews. If He said, yes, pay the tax, the Jews then could portray Him as a traitor and as a Roman collaborator. Certain Jews would even call Him an idolater, since the emperor claimed to be God, and since His image was inscribed on the face of these coins. Some hardcore Jews believed that to pay the tax was to pay homage to the idol in Rome. But on the other hand, if Jesus said, no, I'm not going to pay the tax, then they could report Him to the Romans and get the Romans involved. The Roman authorities would have considered someone saying not to pay their taxes as high treason. Rome was tolerant of divergent religious beliefs, but they were unbending when it came to political allegiance. Any hint of rebellion, and they would move quickly to squelch it. The Jews had crafted this question to trap Jesus, and they thought they had him. But Jesus said, "Show me a denarius." A denarius was a small silver coin, about the size of our dime. He says, "Whose image and inscription does it have?" On one side of the coin was a bust of Caesar. And it had the caption, "Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus." On the other side were the words, "Pontifex Maximus," which is Latin for high priest. The coin was dedicated to the emperor. They answered and they said, "Caesar's image is on the coin." And he said to them, "Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." But they could not catch him in his words in the presence of the people, and they marveled at his answer and kept silent. 2,000 years later, we're still marveling over Jesus' answer to this question. Kent Hughes writes, "The statement of our Lord was not only astounding the instant it was uttered, but it is even today universally acclaimed to be the single most influential political statement ever made in the history of the world." You see, in the ancient world, coins were understood to be the property of the person whose image was on them. Thus, Jesus is saying, "If this is Caesar's coin, then give it back to him. But while you're at it, give to God what belongs to God." And where do we find the image of God? It's stamped within each of us. You and I, mankind, was made in the image and likeness of God. Jesus, in essence, is saying here, give your coins to Caesar, but give your life to God. In amazing brevity and conciseness, Jesus affirms both the validity and the limits of human government. God is supreme, but Caesar has his place. The government has a right to lay claim to your money, but only God has a right to lay claim to your life. Then some of the Sadducees, who deny that there is a resurrection, came to him and asked him. The Pharisees were the conservatives, whereas the Sadducees were the liberals. The Sadducees only considered the first five books of Moses to be divinely inspired. They denied the existence of angels, the afterlife, and the resurrection of the dead. That's why they were sad, you see. You knew that was coming. And so they asked him, saying, "Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies having a wife and he dies without children, his brother shall take his wife and raise up offspring for his brother. This was the law of the Levirate." Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 10 describes this law in detail. Levir is a Latin word which means brother-in-law. It was the brother-in-law's job to raise up an heir for his deceased brother. Now there were seven brothers. And the first took a wife and died without children. And the second took her as wife, and he died childless. Then the third took her, and in like manner the seven also. And they left no children and died. This reminds me of the woman who called her husband Henry because he was the eighth. Actually, did you hear about the woman who had 16 husbands? You know, she told her girlfriend, "You know, I heard a preacher once say that you could have 16 husbands." "Where did you hear him say that?" "Well, I went to a wedding and he said, 4 better, 4 worse, 4 richer, 4 poorer. 16. Truthfully, this sounds like material for the Maury Povich show. Jenny Jones needs to interview this woman. Here's a woman who marries seven brothers. I want to know what this gal had against men. She killed off all seven of the brothers. By the fifth or sixth husband, I would imagine that the pastor was, you know, administering the marriage vows and the last rites at the same time. Did you hear about the woman who had a dream? An angel appeared to her in her dream and announced, "Prepare yourself for widowhood. Your husband is about to die a violent death." The woman responded, "Will I be acquitted?" This woman had buried 7 husbands. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife does she become? For all 7 had her as wife. They said this snickering because they never really believed in the resurrection in the first place. And Jesus answered and said to them, "The sons of this age marry and are given in marriage. But those who are counted worthy to attain that age and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, nor can they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection." Now I imagine if you've got a good marriage, this is probably bad news. But if you've got a bad marriage, this is good news because it won't last forever. There's going to be no marrying and giving in marriage in heaven. Remember, marriage exists on earth only as a picture of our relationship with Jesus Christ, Christ's relationship with His church. In heaven, I believe we'll still be intimate with other human beings, but probably the most casual friendship in heaven will be much more meaningful and heartfelt than the deepest marriage here on earth. There will be no marriage between human beings because the dominant relationship in all of our lives will be our relationship with Christ. The focus will be on our marriage to Him. And our marriage to Him will make all other human marriages totally unnecessary. He says we'll no longer die. We'll be equal to the angels and the sons of God. The sons of God, the phrase sons of God, are Bini Elohim, was an Old Testament synonym for angels. And as the angels are immortal, likewise, our resurrected bodies will no longer be subject to decay. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, "For this corruptible body will put on incorruption, and this mortal body will put on immortality." Now, even Moses showed in the burning bush passage that the dead are raised. When he called the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. For He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. For all live to Him. Jesus could have gone to numerous passages in the Old Testament to prove the resurrection of the dead. But the Sadducees, remember, only considered the first 5 books of Moses to be divinely inspired. This is why Jesus takes His argument from one of the books of Moses, the passage on the burning bush in Exodus. He's saying here, if God is the God of the living, and He's also the God of Abraham, He calls Himself the God of Abraham, well then that means that old Abe is still alive and kicking. There is an afterlife. There is a resurrection from the dead. Then some of the scribes answered and said, "Teacher, You have spoken well." But after that, they dared not question Him anymore. This has been a real showdown, a real theological shootout. Spiritual six shooters have been blazing. Smoke fills the room. Pharisees and Sadducees are dead, strewn all over the place. When the smoke clears, Jesus is the only shootist still standing. But before He puts His gun back in His holster, He says to these guys, "Wait a minute, I've got a question for you." And He said to them, "How can they say that the Christ is David's son?" Now remember, Christos, the Greek word, is the Hebrew word Messiah. So how can they say that the Messiah is David's son? Now David himself said in the book of Psalms, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool." David therefore calls Him Lord. How is He then His son? 2 Samuel 7 verse 12 made it clear that the Messiah would be born into the family of David. And yet Jesus here quotes David in Psalm 110 verse 1 as calling the Messiah his Lord. Now there was only one person greater than the king, and that was God. And yet David calls the Messiah his Lord, you know, saying that the Messiah is greater than him. And so how can the Messiah be David's son and yet be David's God at the same time? This was a new concept. The Jews had never considered this before. They had considered the human nature of Jesus. They acknowledged his humanity when they referred to him as the son of David, but they had never considered that the Messiah was actually more than a man, that he had a divine nature. And here Jesus introduces a new concept. He wants them to consider the deity of the Messiah. You see, he's trying to loosen their grip on certain misconceptions that they've adopted about the Messiah. This was why they rejected him in the first place. He didn't meet their expectations. And he's trying to show them how that their expectations were wrong. He wanted to get them back to the Scriptures, back to the drawing board, to show them that they needed to reevaluate their concepts and understandings of the Messiah. Tragically, they stopped questioning Jesus, but they didn't start questioning their own assumptions. And we know the end of the story. They grilled Jesus on Monday, and they killed Jesus on Thursday, because they were too proud to consider that they had made a mistake, and there was a part of the story that they hadn't read. Jesus tries to get them back to the Scriptures, but they're unwilling. Then in the hearing of all the people, he said to his disciples, "Beware of the scribes who desire to walk in long robes, love greetings in the marketplaces, the best seats in the synagogues, and the best places at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation." Then he looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. Jesus had warned them of such a guy. Now here he comes. In the temple there were 13 offering boxes. Brass offering boxes that were shaped like inverted megaphones. Each of the boxes accumulated money that went for different purposes. Before the rich man dropped in his impressive offering, he made a pompous show of his giving that caught the eye of the disciples. But Jesus' eyes were focused elsewhere. Jesus saw also a certain poor widow putting in two mites. The English word mite is the equivalent of the Jewish lepta, an inconsequential sum, a very small amount. One lepta was worth maybe an eighth of a cent. Therefore, these two lepta were worth about a quarter of a penny. That's all she had. But Jesus said, "Truly I say to you, that this poor widow has put in more than all. For all these out of their abundance have put in offerings for God. But she out of her poverty has put in all the livelihood that she had." Most people tip God from their surplus. Only a few know the joys of really giving to God. The widow's example teaches us that the value, the appraisal of a gift, is measured not by what a man gives to God, but by what a man keeps for himself. It's measured not by what is given over, but by what is left over. The woman was commended because she gave all. The rich man gave much more than she did, but she gave all. And that's what impressed God. Man focuses on the portion of the gift, but God sees the proportion. And by it, he measures the condition of our hearts. Then as some spoke of the temple, Matthew says it was the disciples actually speaking of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations. The disciples of Jesus were raving over the temple, and indeed they had a reason to rave. Jewish historian Josephus writes, "The exterior of the temple lacked nothing. It astounded both mind and eye. For being covered on all sides with massive plates of gold, the sun was no sooner up that it radiated so fiery a flash that persons straining to look at it were compelled to avert their eyes as from the solar rays. To approaching strangers, it appeared from a distance like a snow-clad mountain. And for all that was not overlaid with gold, was purest white, the whitest marble. Of the donations that Jesus mentions, Herod had given a golden vine to the temple, which had on it a cluster of grapes as tall as a man. Even the Egyptian king, Ptolemy, donated a golden desk to the temple. The temple and its treasures were reason to rave. But Jesus responds, "As for these things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone will be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." This prediction was literally fulfilled in 70 AD when the Romans laid siege to the city of Jerusalem. We're told that one of the Roman soldiers got impatient. And while the Jews were held up in the temple, he threw a torch into the temple and it caught fire. And it became so hot that these wonderful plates of gold that were placed on the sides of the temple that Josephus wrote about, that they began to melt. And the liquid gold started oozing into the crevices between the stones. The Roman soldiers were so greedy that they took the stones and they tore them apart from each other. Not one stone was left upon another so that they could get at the gold and they could find every little ounce of gold that had melted and flowed into the cracks. Jesus' prediction came true. And they asked him, saying, "Teacher, but when will these things be? And what sign will there be when these things are about to take place?" In Matthew 24, verse 1, three questions were actually asked Jesus by his disciples. They said to him there, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" Here are the three questions. When will the temple be destroyed? What will be the sign of Jesus' return? And what will signal the end of the age? Jesus answers all three questions in these following verses. He said, "Take heed that you do not be deceived. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he.' And the time has drawn near. Therefore, do not go after them." Certain signs will signal the end of the age, but spiritual deception is not one of them. Don't panic when you see a barrage of false Christs and false claims. For in this present age, in the age of man, spiritual deception will prove to be the status quo, more the rule than the exception. But when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified, for these things must come to pass, but the end will not come immediately. What else do you expect from a world that rejects the Prince of Peace? Chaos and commotion and conflict become run of the mill when you run from God's will. But then he said to them, "Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom." Wars are not a sign in and of themselves, but when the number and intensity of these conflicts pick up, and when they begin to occur on a global scale, then that becomes a signal. Prior to this century, we had never had a world war. Now we've had a pair. There are wars all over the face of the earth. Things are picking up. It's a sign of the end times. He says, too, "And there will be great earthquakes in various places." Here's some startling statistics. From 1890 to 1900, there was only one killer quake. One 6.0 earthquake measured on the Richter scale. Only one earthquake anywhere in the world of that magnitude between the years 1890 and 1900. From 1900 to 1910, there were three. From 1910 to 1920, there were two. From 1920 to 1930, there were two. From 1930 to 1940, there were five. From 1940 to 1950, there were four worldwide. From 1950 to 1960, there were nine. From 1960 to 1970, there were 13. From 1970 to 1980, there were 51. From 1980 to 1990, there were 86. And already, in the first 4 years of our decade, 1990 to 1994, there have been over 100 of these killer earthquakes. Jesus says that this is Mother Nature's way of telling us that our Heavenly Father is up to something. I believe that the end of the age is near. Jesus is coming back to judge this wicked world and to establish His kingdom. There will be great earthquakes in various places and famines and pestilences. The AIDS epidemic certainly qualifies as a modern-day pestilence. As for famines, 786 million people, nearly one in every six world residents, are suffering from acute or chronic hunger. More than 1 billion more face serious starvation. About 2 billion of the world's 5.5 billion people suffer from food shortages. There will be famines and pestilence, and there will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven. Freak weather patterns will also signal the end of the age. The early 90s has seen an abnormal occurrence of snowstorms and thunderstorms and floodings and tornadoes and hurricanes. Time magazine calls it the weird weather phenomenon. Take Friday's low temperature, for example. In Tower, Minnesota, it was 60 degrees below zero. The coldest ever in the state of Minnesota. Scientists explain these quirks due to environmental factors, but perhaps there's more. One New Yorker stranded in the violent winter storm of 1992 made this comment, "I feel like I'm caught in something biblical. You know, one of the great plagues. I'm expecting to see Noah's Ark floating up Third Avenue." Perhaps something biblical is going on. Signs are appearing in the heavens that the world is winding down. But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. And you will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. But it will turn out for you an occasion for testimony. There has always been a certain amount of persecution, but as the persecution intensifies, we recognize that it's a sign. This English word martyr, comes from the Greek word martis, which means witness. Persecution is always an opportunity for proclamation. God knows that Christians are like tea bags. When you put them in hot water, what's in them finally comes out. And whenever we encounter persecution, God is setting the stage for us to witness for Him. When we're persecuted for Christ's sake, it's as if God is putting the microphone up to your face, giving you an opportunity to proclaim your faith in Christ. He says, "Therefore, settle it in your hearts, not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer. For I will give you a mouth in wisdom, which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist." We need to prepare, obviously. Peter tells us, "Always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you." And yet it's impossible to prepare for every contingency. Most of the opportunities I have to witness take me by surprise. They're unplanned and they're unexpected, and preparations are really impossible. But it's in those spontaneous moments that the Lord promises to give us the right word at the right time, to come alongside, to give us wisdom greater than our own. He says, "You will be betrayed even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends, and they will send some of you to your death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head shall be lost. In your patience, possess your souls." Again, a sign of the end will be this intensification of persecution. This will especially be true once the church is gone. During the first half of the Great Tribulation, God will raise up 144,000 Jewish witnesses to testify of Christ. And despite the attacks from the enemy, they'll be miraculously protected, as Jesus says here. Now, Jesus has given signs for the end of the age. In the next few verses, he takes up the question that his disciples ask him about the destruction of the temple. When is the temple going to be destroyed? Jesus says, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. And let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. For there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people." It's sad to read the histories that report on the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. The Romans cut off the supply lines to the city. And they laid siege to Jerusalem for 5 long months. The Jewish historian Josephus was an eyewitness of the atrocities that occurred in the penned-up city. History tells us that approximately 600,000 Jews died of starvation during the siege. Their bodies were tossed over the wall of the city at a rate of 4,000 each day. Famine and starvation drove the 3 million Jews that had come into the city to hide and to protect themselves against the Romans. It drove them mad, insane, the famine. All kinds of cruel things were done within the city walls during this siege. Josephus writes, "Wives would snatch the food from husbands, children from fathers, and most pitiable of all, mothers from the very mouths of their infants. Old men were beaten, clutching their food, and women were dragged by the hair, concealing what was in their hands. There was no compassion. Children actually lifted up with the fragments to which they clung and were dashed to the ground." The situation was so bad that Josephus saw one woman slaughter her own son, roast his body and eat half of it, storing the rest. He writes again, "The roofs were thronged with women and babies completely exhausted. The alleys, the corpses of the aged, children and youths with swollen figures roamed like phantoms through the marketplaces and collapsed wherever their doom overtook them." Josephus tells how that some of the Jews swallowed their money, their gold coins, and then surrendered to the enemy. When one of the Jewish prisoners was seen picking through his excrement, picking out the gold coins that he had flushed through his system, the word got around the Roman camp that the Jews were full of gold. And so from then on, the Romans started gutting their prisoners and searching their intestines for loot. Josephus concluded this about Jerusalem: "No other city ever endured such miseries. Not since the world began." These miseries were the great distress that Jesus predicted would come upon this people. This didn't have to happen. There was no need for this to happen. If the city had just embraced its Messiah, Jesus had cried out the day before, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I've wanted to gather you to my side, under my wing. But you were not willing." This didn't have to happen. It was because of their stubbornness that this great distress came upon the city. And they will fall by the edge of the sword. Over 1 million Jews were slaughtered by the Romans. And be led away captive into all nations. The Jews the Romans took prisoner numbered 95,000. In fact, when the walls fell and the Romans came into the city like a flood, a number of the Jews tried to hide in the underground caves there below Jerusalem. But Josephus writes, "This proved to be but a dream, for they were not destined to elude either God or the Romans." Even the Jewish historian recognized that this slaughter, this siege, was the judgment of God. Because they rejected Jesus, God had rejected them. And for the last 2,000 years, the Jews have lived in dispersion, scattered among the nations of the world as a result of their rejection of Christ. It's only been in our day, our generation, that God has returned them to their land and restored their nation. He says, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Even after such a devastating defeat, the Jews tried another revolt against the Romans in 135 B.C. This rebellion was led by a man named Simon Bar Kokhba that the Jewish religious leaders embraced as their Messiah. They had rejected their true Messiah, but they accepted and embraced this false Messiah, Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba led a guerrilla campaign. And in fact, he had some measure of success. For a while, he took possession of Jerusalem. He even tried to rebuild the temple. But the revolt was quickly crushed, and an additional 580,000 Jews were killed. This time, the Romans said, this is it. They barred any Jew from entering the city of Jerusalem. If a Jew tried, the crime was punishable by death. They built a temple to Jupiter on Mount Moriah. They renamed Jerusalem Alaia Capitolina, and they barred the Jews from entering. The city remained under the control of Rome, of the Gentiles, for the next 5 centuries until it fell to the Muslims in 637 A.D., And from 637 to 1917, Jerusalem has been a Muslim city, except for a brief period during the Crusades. It wasn't until June the 6th, 1967, that the city was finally returned to Jewish hands. During the famous Six-Day War, Israeli General Moshe Dayan led his paratroopers into the old city of Jerusalem and took it from the Arabs. For the first time in almost 1900 years, Jerusalem was out from under Gentile control. And yet, Dayan made a terrible mistake. He maintained Israeli military authority over Jerusalem, but to pacify the Arabs, he agreed to partition the city into 4 quarters: the Armenian, the Christian, the Muslim, and the Jewish quarter. To further appease the Muslims, he foolishly allowed their religious authority, the Waqf, to maintain control over the Temple Mount. Jerusalem is still being trampled under the feet of the Gentiles, though their feet don't fall quite so heavily these days. When Jesus returns, he's going to put to an end all Gentile jurisdiction over Jerusalem. He's going to drive the Gentiles out of the capital city of the Jews and make Jerusalem his capital, the capital of his glorious kingdom. And there will be signs in the sun, in the moon, and in the stars, and on the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them from fear and the expectation of those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Jesus came the first time in weakness and in humility. When he appears a second time, it will be in power and in great glory. Prior to his coming, God will rock the world with cataclysmic judgments, global judgment. Today's natural disasters are minute in comparison. Nature is just warming up to cooperate with God in judging this world for its wickedness. Now when these things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads because your redemption draws near. Thomas Campbell once said, "Coming events cast their shadows beforehand." And the shadows of prophecy are certainly lingering over today's current events. Jesus is coming back soon, and we need to be on our toes spiritually, prepped and prepared, passionate about our Lord and about His work. And He spoke to them a parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. When they are already budding, you see and know for yourselves that summer is now near. So you likewise, when you see these things happening, know that the kingdom of God is near. Now it's possible that Jesus is simply saying here that the budding of the fig tree, or the greening of the leaves. You know, the budding of the fig tree is like the greening of the leaves. When the leaves start turning green, you know that the seasons are about to change. And when you see these signs that he's just described, you know that these events are about to happen. The second coming of Christ is about to occur. That may be all that's inferred here in this verse. But there's another possibility. For often in the scriptures, the fig tree is a symbol of the nation Israel. And there are many that see here a prophecy of the rebirth of the nation Israel. And so Jesus is saying that one of the signs of his return is the rebirth or the reestablishment of the nation Israel. If this passage doesn't teach this truth, there are many, many other passages that do. After 1900 years in dispersion, the Jewish people have maintained their identity and their nationalism and their religion. And now they have returned to their land and reestablished their nation. Their accomplishment is unprecedented in the annals of history. God has done the impossible. The fig tree that he once cursed has rebudded. And it's a signal that the Lord's return is near. It's been said God's timepiece is not a Bulova or a Rolex. It's the nation Israel. And now that Israel has returned to the land and been reestablished, all of the scenarios are falling into place. The rebirth of the nation Israel is an incredible sign. It tells us that the winter of man is about over and the springtime of Christ's coming is on the horizon. He says, "Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all things are fulfilled." He's speaking of that generation that witnesses the budding of the fig tree. Those who witnessed Israel's independence in 48 and the liberation of Jerusalem in 67 may well be the generation that sees the long-awaited return of Jesus Christ. That would mean us. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. What God promises, you can take to the bank. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, or partying, and drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. You remember when Lady Lot, Lot's wife, was being led out of Sodom. You remember she balked. Her heart looked back because her treasure was in Sodom. She was too attached to the things of the world, to the lifestyle, to the pleasures. And she looked back. She had a longing in her heart for something other than God. And when the time came for her escape, because she looked back, she was left behind. You remember she was judged. She was turned into a pillar of salt, a podium of sodium. Jesus is warning us here not to get wrapped up in the sideshows of this world. Don't get distracted from what's eternal by what's temporal and superficial. Helen Van Dyke was an 82-year-old woman. An American woman who had lived her whole life in Cairo, Egypt. When the U.S. came out in support of Israel in the war with the Egyptians, the Egyptian authorities decided to deport all Americans living in Cairo. Mrs. Van Dyke was told to report to the deportation area in 15 minutes. She complained, "I have lived my whole life in Cairo. How can I pack up a lifetime in 15 minutes. And yet that's a question that we're all going to have to answer one day. We're all going to have to pack up a lifetime. But not in 15 minutes. We're going to have to pack up a lifetime in the twinkling of an eye. Be certain that you're living for what you can take with you. Don't waste your life on what's going to get left behind. Make sure that your heart is involved with the things of God, that your mind is set on Jesus. Watch, therefore, and pray. Always, that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. For those of you who are new to Bible prophecy, Jesus is actually coming back twice. He comes after a period of final judgment to mop up and set up. He deals with the bad guys personally and he establishes his kingdom on the earth. But before the great tribulation, he comes to snatch up. He takes up his church. He lifts them up before the wrath of God comes down. An escape is offered to those who are ready. We need to make sure that we are ready. That we're prepped up and prayed up. That we're pure and ready and passionate about Jesus. And in the daytime, he was teaching in the temple. But at night he went out and stayed on the mountain called Olivet. Probably went back to Bethany and stayed at the house of Lazarus and his sisters. Then early in the morning, all the people came to him in the temple to hear him. And there we'll end tonight. Next week we move further into the story. Into the last day of Jesus' earthly life. We've moved into the last week. Into that Monday. Rainy days and Mondays always get me down. This Monday was a downer. It was a bummer. The Jews had an opportunity to embrace Jesus as their Savior, as their Messiah. And yet they chose to harden their hearts against Him. Isn't it interesting how the gospel records slow down when we come to the crucifixion of Jesus Christ? They want us to understand. The gospel writers wanted us to really understand the dynamics that were going on. That's what we'll get into next week.